And in fact, as I have argued, in concluding in that lecture I mentioned on YouTube at the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill, given in February 2018, that you basically had three factions amongst the settler population. You had a pro-slavery faction led by George Washington that triumphed in 1776. And you had a rather small, authentic anti-slavery faction as symbolized by John Brown, the Euro-American who tried to overthrow slavery in 1859 and then was captured and executed. And of course, he's still considered a hero in Haiti. And then you had an inauthentic anti-slavery faction, which was symbolized certainly by the early Lincoln, if not by the late Lincoln, which says, not only get rid of slavery, but get rid of the Negroes. This was part of the white man's country faction. And I dare say that the white man's country faction is still potent, although the political correctness they repeatedly and continually deride forbids them from attaching that label, quite rightly, to their philosophy, that is to say, wanting North America and the United States as a white man's country faction. And that is the faction that emerged triumphant in 1865 over the pro-slavery George Washington Jefferson Davis faction, and then proceeded to impose Jim Crow segregation. They were not able to expel us altogether, so they created an internal exile for us, creating these so-called all-white spaces, which still persist, as you know. I'm sure you follow the news about the black men who were expelled from a Starbucks in Philadelphia just days ago, for example. There are numerous examples to that end. That's an expression of trying to create this white man's country faction embodied in 2018. So I guess some of your listeners may say that given that very unfavorable balance of forces that the Africans and the indigenous faced with a pro-slavery faction or the white man's country faction basically being the overwhelming majority, how were we able to escape? Well, if you listen carefully, I think you'll understand that we were able to escape and overcome our persecution by global alliances with Haitian revolutionaries, with British abolitionists in the 20th century, with Mexican revolutionaries. Look at my book, Black and Brown, Mexican Revolution, African Americans of the Mexican Revolution, 1910 to 1920. With relations with Asia, look at my book, Facing the Rising Sun, African Americans, Japan, and the Rise of Afro-Asian Solidarity. With relations with Bolshevik Russia, as represented by the socialist movement, and in fact, 1917 and the Bolshevik Revolution, what it does, among other things, is that it helps to erode this maniacal obsession with race and phobia and hatred and fear towards African peoples, erode, not eliminate, was the verb I chose, in part because of apprehension and nervousness about the rise of the class project represented by socialism. And that, of course, helps to attract many of the luminaries of our community, including Paul Robeson. Look at my biography on Paul Robeson, by the way. Shirley Graham Du Bois, the spouse of W.B. Du Bois, look at my biography of her. W.B. Du Bois himself, look at my biography of W.B. Du Bois. And that particular relationship helps to create a crisis for white supremacy that reaches a deafening crescendo in 1950 when Paul Robeson files a petition at the United Nations charging the United States with genocide against black people. And for his troubles, he is persecuted. His opportunity to sing, because he was a singer and actor and a political activist to boot, are circumscribed, and he's not allowed to leave the country to pursue his art abroad. But it does create a crisis, not least because Washington is trying to portray itself as a paragon of human rights virtue in the ideological conflict with the then socialist camp. The socialist camp is trying to appeal to Africa, not least Kwame Nkrumah's Ghana, not least Patrice Lumumba's Congo. The United States has to compete, and therefore it's forced reluctantly and unwillingly in 1954 through Brown versus Board of Education to say that, you know what, Jim Crow is unconstitutional and illegal. And that leads to further crises when that decision is sought to be implemented in Little Rock, Arkansas in 1957 at Central High School, causing President Eisenhower to send federal troops to guard young black students from being mauled and attacked by their white classmates as they try to get an education. It causes Virginia a few years later to shut down its public school and then subsidize the public education through rich Euro-Americans of poor Euro-American students and depriving poor black people, for the most part, of education altogether. This is so you have poor black people who are still with us, who are deprived of education altogether because of this maniacal desire to have Jim Crow education. But this increased pressure then leads to the 64 Civil Rights Act, supposedly barring what you saw at Starbucks just a few days ago. That is to say, we have access to public accommodations. The 65 Voting Rights Act, which is now in the process of being garroted and destroyed. And I should also say parenthetically that the NAACP collaborated with the U.S. authorities. They were very short-sighted. They helped to boycott Paul Robeson. They thought that there had been a permanent settlement of what used to be called the Negro question with the Brown versus Board of Education decision, but actually it was just a truce. It wasn't a permanent settlement. And anybody knows that when conditions change, either party can renege on a truce, and that's what's happening now. That is to say that the socialist camp has eroded, and that initial pressure that led the United States to move reluctantly away from Jim Crow has receded. And so now, with the November 2016 election of Donald J. Trump, you see the counter-revolution in motion. And counter-revolution, I would say, has been the motive force of the history of the United States ever since 1776, when there was a counter-revolution against London because there was a fear that London was moving towards the abolition of slavery. And by the way, those who are interested in history and making comparisons should draw a connection between 1776 and what happened in what is now Zimbabwe, then Rhodesia, in 1965, when a so-called white minority regime sought to secede from the British Empire, just like George Washington did in 1776. George Washington seeking to escape the Royal Proclamation of 1763 and Somerset's case of 1772, Ian Smith and the races in Rhodesia fearing that London was about to install African majority rule. So they seceded, and Ian Smith said he was walking in the footsteps of 1776. See my book, From the Barrel of a Gun, the United States in the War Against Zimbabwe, 1965 to 1980, for further detail. In any case, that brings us to the present moment.